Good afternoon. Welcome to the Manhattan Institute's Innovative Ideas podcast for medical progress today. Our guest today is Stephen T. Parente, an associate professor in the Department of Finance at the Carlson School of Management at the University of Minnesota. Dr. Parente specializes in health economics, health insurance, medical technology, evaluation, and health information technology. He's also director of the Carlson School's Medical Industry Leadership Institute. Steve, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you, Paul. Pleasure to be here.
Steve, today I wanted to talk a little bit about an estimate that you and some of your colleagues at Carlson put out just a few days ago, late last week actually, on the impact of health reform reconciliation bill. Of course, the bill that recently passed Congress and is going into the Senate, I guess, for a vote today. Mm-hmm. Your HSI estimate differs from the CBO estimate. And just to run over those numbers very quickly, CBO estimates 10-year cost of the bill, about $940 billion. They also project deficit reduction somewhere in the neighborhood of $130, $138 billion. Your estimate for the 10-year cost of the bill was $1.36 trillion, so it's about a third more expensive.
Right.
And then you also see a deficit increase of $287 billion. Could you talk for a few minutes about why the HSI analysis came in at a different price point than the CBO's?
Sure. The biggest thing that contributes to that is that the reconciliation bill makes the subsidies that would come online in 2014 more generous. And by making those subsidies to consumers more generous, what they could in effect do is have consumers trade up their plans, meaning in a world with, say, four tiers of bronze, silver, gold, and platinum, you can see folks going from silver to gold, perhaps, and given that silver is the indexing, that could potentially increase premiums by somewhere between 15 to 20%. You can also see the same thing happening with folks maybe trading up between bronze and silver as well, same issues in terms of costs going up. So that's the primary reason why that's in place. There was actually some reductions, though it wasn't all increases that were possible, because the reconciliation language, or at least the intent of it from coming out of the White House meeting, was to talk something about HSAs, or at least supporting high deductible plans. And so we sort of allow the high deductible plans to become a more robust choice set. That said, we also had the high deductible plans have more coverage than they currently do, and that also had an increase on the premium as well. So that's why the $1.36 trillion number comes into place. And then the reason why we have a deficit is that we actually took CBO at their word. Now, we have our own way of doing our deficit savings calculation, but really the savings that CBO estimates of the roughly $130 billion comes from Medicare cuts, mostly. And, I mean, those are happening, it seems, no matter what. What we say is, look, if you're finding that you can have deficit savings of $130 billion and the CBO 10-year cost is $940 billion, the difference of the $287 billion is basically to say, look, you're spending more than you thought you would, and what was a deficit savings of $130 billion now becomes actually an additional expense to the deficit, or adds to the deficit of $287 billion.
And that's primarily a result of the exchanges and the subsidies in the exchanges limiting out-of-pocket spending and encouraging people to bid up, in effect, for more comprehensive plans.
That's exactly right. And I think that was part of the intent of the reconciliation bill, really the difference between the House and the Senate. The House always had a more generous design than the Senate did, at least in terms of what got voted on at the end of last year. And that's really what this is reflecting.
So the other question, though, how is this going to interact with a system of insurance regulation? The bill also gives the HHS the ability to review premium increases in the private market and disallow them or force rebates in a way. So if costs are going up because demand's increasing and people are demanding these richer benefit sets, and presumably people who haven't had insurance before are now going to be using more health care,
right,
because they're covered, insurers are going to see increases in their costs. They could turn around and ask HHS for premium increases that could be fairly steep, but that might be disallowed. What kind of world would that be when costs are going up and insurers are told that they can't increase their premiums to account for that?
Well, it's going to be a fun world. There's really a few ways that can actually play out, and it's really a key question here, Paul. First is, if, for example, the insurance commissioner body, which, as I understand in the reconciliation bill, would be federal, it would supersede state regs, that's a major difference. It's actually currently not in the Senate bill. That would cap, in effect, the insurance premiums, as you said. Given what the incentives are, there's really two options that can occur, given that the HHS secretary is also controlling benefit design. Either there could be more money that has to be put into play for the cost of these programs, so that goes beyond the estimates I had in terms of just bidding up the plans, but actually requires additional subsidy just to kind of make those things operate, and effectively has health plans now going on at a rebated rate. which is quite different than what they've been operating at previously or just doesn't exist. That's option one. Option two, which I think most folks in the House who are fairly liberal on this topic would probably not like, is for the high deductible health plans to become the mechanism by which you could actually have your cake and eat it too on this. So what would happen is that there might be something in terms of the loss ratio, which is really how this is being governed in terms of the policy, and the Senate bill right now saying it has to hit X proportion of dollars that are going out and there can only be so much loading and profit or other things to come back.
I think it has to be 85% in the group market and
right.
80% in the individual market.
Exactly. So an HS, a high deductible plan can actually fit that scenario, and particularly with the prevention that's going to be required for it to thrown on. And so as the premium increases could occur, the thought is to say, look, we're going to fit this with a high deductible plan option instead of these very generous options that otherwise are going to force a major subsidy from the federal government. So in effect, the combination of those two forces you're describing, Paul, the restrictions in terms of rate increases as well as the increased demand might actually be the biggest accelerator of the use of high deductible plans there ever was. And quite honestly, that was not the intent, I'm pretty sure, of most of the folks advocating health reform.
Now, could you walk us through that just for a moment? Would it be that the HHS would then redefine the silver plan as a HSA deductible?
It could ultimately be the way. My guess is that the benefit design would have to change. I mean, this is one thing we're not clear about is what really is still going to, what will ultimately be bronze and silver. Typically, high deductible plans, if you look at the Massachusetts Connectors experience, fall into the bronze category, not the silver category. Now, what makes the high deductible plans more interesting now is, I think this happens with the Senate bill no matter what, prevention now must be part of the plans. And so that will marginally increase the premium costs of the high deductible plans. It will also provide enough spend because of just well-child visits and physical exams such that the loss ratio situation for the plans will improve. And ultimately, you could have a situation where the silver plan might ultimately become the high deductible plan, as you're saying, because the federal government doesn't want to commit any more subsidy dollars to blow the budget.
And just because all this is very confusing for me, at least, just to cap it up, if you opt for an HSA in the exchanges, as we understand them now, would your voucher, your refundable tax credit, if it was above the premium of the plan, would the remainder of that go into an HSA, or that's just refunded to the government?
I'm pretty sure that's just refunded to the government. My guess is that with the high deductible plans, the amount of money that you're putting in your HSA, at least as I see it right now, there's no restrictions on those at all, or requirements, I should say. No one is saying you must put at least $100 into the account. That could easily change. The insurance commissioner can come back and say, for these things to be competitive, they have to put something into that account. It does get very gray, because what does that $100, say, become? Does that become part of the medical loss ratio? Is it outside the loss ratio? Is it a different requirement? As I understand the legislation, the secretary can say whatever they would like about this, and it could become law. But you're right, it's a different flavor. I'll tell you, when we modeled this with HSI, we did assume some money was being put into the accounts. That's actually a pretty conservative assumption, because about half the accounts have either zero or very few balances in them.
Last question, just to wrap up. If you were thinking about, gee, how could I reform this in a way that would put some better cost controls back into it and make it more of a market-oriented plan, is there any way you could, say, make it a flat refundable credit for, say, an HSA-style plan? Say, here it is. You can buy this. Everybody gets this. You can buy this plan. Anything you want else for you is going to be a la carte. Would that be one approach you could use?
Yeah, that's one approach. And I guess as this rolls forward, that's probably the approach I'd be advocating for lack of a better term, fixing the bill. I think if there is going to be some sort of tax credit, I think capping it so that it more or less pays for a high deductible health plan, and it might be able to be indexed a little bit on need. This is where it can be bolstered by perhaps a high-risk pool and actually make the high-risk pool have much more teeth in terms of, or just technical teeth in terms of what it's doing. That would, in effect, probably address most consumers' anxieties about health insurance, which is they want something there in case of a catastrophic event. I think leaving the prevention in place is fine in terms of that price point. But in the end, what you might have is simply, really they'd be almost vouchers, but they could be either way, vouchers or tax credits, essentially paying for a high deductible plan and really nothing more in terms of an actuarial value. And then if anybody wants anything else, you're free to get it. When we have done the HSI analyses before, and this is part of what we did with the McCain folks too long ago, we found that pretty much on a sustainable basis, a high deductible health plan subsidy is about all we can afford if we're going to be playing with the Cadillac tax or other mechanisms to find the revenues to pay for health reform without tapping into Medicare. So I guess the answer there really, Paul, is stay tuned. I think the issue is going to start to come to play if, as the bill evolves and more things are added to it, say the doc fix is put back in and stuff that Doug Holtz-Eakin has talked about in terms of the true cost once everything's layered into this, or Paul Ryan from Wisconsin, at some point CBO has to pay attention to that, and actually probably the bond market has to pay attention to it too, or treasuries do. And once that happens, I think it becomes a different dynamic about what the U.S. can actually afford, and then maybe a high-deductible health credit is our only way out to keep some sort of lid on this without it exploding.
Well, that's a terrific point to end on. Stay tuned for further developments, possibly not all of them pretty. Steve, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Paul. It's been great.